The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
First of all, I just want to say that we all know that fathers can be given to us, or we can choose them, find them in the world, and anybody can do the work of parenting. Some mothers have to do it all. It's not bound by gender or sex, but still we have these names, these words, these relationships. People we call father. If you read people's reflections on their fathers, you see and hear so many different kinds of fathers described. Gifts fathers leave behind. And challenges. Liza Minnelli said her mother gave her her drive, but her father gave her her dreams. Queen Elizabeth II said, I am my father's daughter and not afraid. I should say, I am my father's daughter, but I'm afraid I'll butcher it and become Cockney by the end, and not afraid of anything. People testify to fathers who showed by example how to live. We have people who talk about how much their fathers spoke to them of how much they were loved and appreciated, and people who have fathers who spoke of none of it. Steve Martin said, a father carries pictures of where his money used to be. A testament to some of what we give up when we have children, time, money, sometimes some of our dreams, certainly a bunch of freedom. Any fool can have a child, Barack Obama once said. That doesn't make you a father. It is the courage to raise a child that makes you a father. Obama's right. To be a father, a parent, is to put ourselves in the arena of life in the most intimate way, not as a spectator, but in a place where all of who you are is on full display and to the most scrutinizing sets of eyes. Kids who see everything, remember almost everything, and for better or for worse, are shaped by all we are and are not. Parenting is the ultimate accountability in life for who we are and what we do, and it's not for the faint of heart. So to begin this tribute to fathers, I first of all want to give a deep bow to all parents or who step in the role of parenting and extend a deep grace. I'm pretty sure that we will never, any of us, see our parents for who they are fully, maybe not until late in life, maybe never. Perhaps we never see anyone who's close to us that close for who they are fully and accurately. I think we always see them more as understandable as to how and who they were for us. So it's from this perspective, imperfect and incomplete, but important, that we're going to approach Father's Day today. From four different perspectives, four different fathers, who they were to us, working to see them a bit more fully, for who they were beyond what we could see and know them as children. Mark, you probably do that most of all among our reflections this morning. But I hope these portraits of legacy that are offered this morning draw out something in your own reflections of the relationships in your life and the people who shaped you, parented you, your fathers, those you call father. I want to name particularly today that there are tables with candles up front available for you to light one for someone you're thinking of anytime you feel moved to.
A lesson I learned from my father is to follow your bite-sized dreams. The classic follow your dreams narrative is grandiose, risky, and not accessible to everyone. Quit your corporate job and make a living as an artist. Give up your apartment and move abroad. But here's a dream that my dad has been able to follow: making games. My family loves playing all forms of board and card games. Frequently, my dad comes up with ideas for games. Rather than just muse on them, sometimes he makes them. I remember when I was a kid, he would go to Staples, buy cardstock, and then painstakingly lay out every card to prototype, for example, a game that was like dominoes, but based on DNA. Then we would play it, and a few weeks later, my dad would make some adjustments, and we would try out the new version. Making a game might sound out of reach to most people, but all it took was conviction that he could do it, passion, and time. And some of the dreams were bigger bites, too. I distinctly remember my dad's involvement in the 2004 Democratic presidential primary. He, like many, was horrified by the Iraq War and worried, correctly, that there was no guarantee of a Democratic nominee who could defeat George W. Bush. So a few months before the primaries, he got excited about Wesley Clark, a four-star general whose values my dad thought would be great for the country and also resonate in swing states. So my dad stepped up as one of the main volunteers for Clark's campaign in Delaware. For months, he would work a full day and then go to the campaign office or bring his work home, making calls, printing things out, and planning the next event. Every weekend, he coordinated at least one Get Out the Vote event. It was inspiring to see my dad dream that his involvement could make a difference in the country and ultimately the world, and to do everything he reasonably could to make that real. I also learned a lot about how he handled the dream not coming true. My dad was disappointed by General Clark's poor electoral performance, but also had no regrets that he did everything he could for a cause that he believed in. My dad also recently self-published a book, which you can just go to Amazon and they'll let you do. He frequently preaches full sermons at Unitarian Universalist congregations and published a compilation of some of his favorite sermons from over the years. He even found a company that helped him lay out the book more expertly and paid a friend to design the cover so that it would look more professional and in line with his vision. Returning to my dad's love of games, in retirement, he has been playing a lot of competitive bridge. And he and one of his partners are even devising a new bidding convention, which, for those of you who don't know bridge, is sort of like a chess opening, or it's basically a new variant of slang in the language that is bridge bidding. So often, the popular idea of following your dreams is seen as this huge, all-or-nothing act. For me, that can be paralyzing. But there's almost always space to pursue a bite-sized dream, and they can add up to a deeply fulfilling life.
My dad, Jesse Lee Greenlee, was a dominant figure in my life growing up. He set the tone, the mood, the atmosphere in our house on a daily basis. We laughed a lot growing up, and there were days when grumpiness reigned. My fondest memory of him was on a day when he was grumpy and I was feeling quite ornery. He loved to make big bowls of popcorn and used a particularly large green Tupperware bowl. You remember those big green Tupperware bowls? Yes. And it was only for him. On this day, I hid behind the corner, and as he was walking towards the living room with his bowl of popcorn, I jumped out and yelled, "Boo!" He jumped in return, and popcorn went flying. Oh, he so tried to get angry. He so tried to get angry. I was on the floor laughing so hard. And he gave in and started laughing as well. The thing is, my dad would always try to jump scare my mom and sister and I. We would be driving in the car, and he would all of a sudden yell, "Boo!" My mom always jumped. She was with the man for over 50 years, and she always jumped. My sister and I eventually said, "Dad, stop." This is often how the lessons from my dad would show up. They were subtle and often just learned through his actions. This first lesson I view as a skill I take quite a bit of pride in. No, and it's not going around and scaring people. It's more about reading the room, reading people, paying attention to what's going on, how to break the tension, pivot a conversation, or just know if someone needs a boost. As with a good jump scare, you have to know how it will be received and determine how to set the stage for it to be a success. Just as you do when you counsel someone or supervise an employee or preach a sermon to a congregation. I remember a Sunday up in Washington State where I had written a sermon and was about to step into the pulpit to deliver it. And I was looking out at the people gathered in the pews and observing and realizing as my heart sunk that the sermon I wrote was not the sermon they needed. The congregation that week had suffered a major shocking loss in their community, and that sermon was written before that loss was realized. So I set the sermon aside and preached a sermon from my heart. Knowing how to read a room full of people allowed me to show up in the way they needed that Sunday. It wasn't a jump scare, but it had the same kind of boost to the spirit of the community. Sometimes the lessons from my dad would show up in frustrating and complicated ways. While growing up, I was a typical child who would ask one parent for something and be told to ask the other parent for the answer. I always went to my mom first, even though I knew most often she would send me to my dad. I didn't like going to ask my dad because without a doubt, every time I would go to ask for something, before I would even get the question fully out, he would say no. I would get so frustrated because I didn't feel like I was heard, would think it was unfair. And sometimes I just got grumpy and just chose not to ask the question. There are times when he was teasing me and let me ask the question without interrupting again. And other times the first no was the answer. And there was no chance of getting that question fully stated. His reasoning, I later learned, was he didn't want me to be afraid of hearing the answer no. I don't think his method was necessarily sound. But the lesson of not being afraid of the answer no has definitely shaped my courage in asking for what I want or need. Whenever I am undecided on whether I want to ask a question, I do hear him clearly in my mind saying, "What's the worst answer you can get? No." And I know that going in, and if no is not the worst, then by imagining what the worst answer could be, then I can prepare myself to hear it and still determine the steps I need to take. Even though his method could have failed miserably, the ability to ask questions without a fear of what the answer might be has served me well. It has given me the courage to ask hard questions when people's lives were at stake, or to push back against unfair practices, or to determine when someone, like my dad, was ready to stop cancer treatment. And that question and that answer was not no. My dad, Jesse Lee Greenlee, died on October 2018 and left me another lesson, which is to live life to the fullest, because you never know when that privilege will be taken away. My dad was loving, oh so complicated, funny, and frustrating, and I'm still learning the subtle lessons he taught me in the time we had together on this earth.
My dad, Paul Sumner, died in the town where he was born, Sepulpa, Oklahoma. He passed at age 68 from pancreatic cancer 1 month after I began work as your choir director here in January of 1998. I will never forget, as he relished a chocolate creamsicle, my father casting his last long look at me. We both had plenty to say, but neither of us could. His eyes spoke volumes, probably thoughts he had long since been wanting to share. I figure with most families, the relationship dynamic over time adjusts a little, but doesn't change all that much. Maybe we comfortably remain who we were, regardless of how much life we had since lived. This is my attempt to show just how much the memory of my father now resonates with me. His mom and dad were cold and guarded. Their norm was not sharing loving words nor acts of affection. I recall the only parental rift in all the time I bore witness was mom's frustration with the in-laws. Even though she strongly felt their influence on dad, I sensed he had evolved, perhaps being a middle child into a more open Sumner, more self-aware and kind. Growing up, they called him Pepper. Dad started a diary the day before my birth, following with a year of daily entries, confirming how prized his firstborn was. Other than a poetic phase later, I'm unaware of any other personal writing until a letter to mom was discovered and read after his death. When he was young, Pepper was allowed a year of piano lessons from a Miss Cantrell. And much, much later, when I turned 5, the year of her death, a very happy father purchased the same Steinway grand on which he had played as a child for $250, and benched me with lessons of my own. Many have heard me crow about how lucky growing up in Sepulpa was if you were a singer, instrumentalist, or dancer even in the 60s and 70s. But it took me until the new millennium to realize my luck in fathers. During our shared lives, I never pictured him as a strong presence. Mother was the one I looked up to, one whose words I marked. Being a closeted queer son, I needed a a strong role model to help guide me down the narrow, if not straight, path. I needed to feel unconditional love. She had lived through challenges, was thoughtful, intelligent, 7 years my father, 7 years older than my father, tuberculosis, World War II. And I saw the needed contrast to my father in her. Even before she passed, 5 years after Dad, I often wondered what sort of life she would have had if born later. Would she have married? What career would she have landed? Where would she have ended up? Vivian was a Bay Area Rosie the Riveter right after high school. And once you've tasted life outside Oklahoma, well, who will know? But Dad tapped into this energy of mine. He taught me how to type using an Underwood at age 8. I proceeded to retype the World Book Encyclopedia he purchased for us when I was 10. He got me a job at the local movie theater in the 8th grade, where he had formerly worked as an usher. My love for classic film, thank you, Dad. Before the 10th grade, my 80 words a minute and some nepotism led me to work all the different office jobs at Leeway Motor Freight in Tulsa, downtown Tulsa. Dad was the office manager and Mom worked nights. I took over for everyone while they enjoyed summer vacations. I had to join the Teamsters Union, and in 1969, was paid over $8 an hour. Dad, in phases, gave us some art, some gardening. Some of you remember Columbia House Record Club. He entertained the locals on Halloween, creating scary scenes on our front porch. He drove my piano teacher and I to Oklahoma City to hear Van Cliburn perform. Side comment, can you imagine a classical pianist turning America upside down with a ticker tape parade today? Progress, they say, takes 2 steps forward, 1 step back. I wonder about that. I only get 1 soapbox today, sorry. Sorry. Anyway, his beefsteak tomatoes delighted an entire neighborhood. He even created the neighborhood, along with his younger brother, after investing in some land east of Sepulpa. He was thrilled to donate a strip of this land to Sepulpa's only non-Protestant faith, the Catholics, whose property abutted his. When my sister later married a Catholic, it gave both of my parents a great excuse to bid goodbye to their church to childhood, pass the exam or whatever, and get confirmed. Mom, originally a Methodist, could smoke outside with a Monsignor, wear comfortable clothing, sleep in if necessary. There was no pretense of being any sort of virtuous character, which she abhorred. Earlier in Dad's family church, the First Church of Christ, Sepulpa, my parents, after some notable absence, were paraded in front of the congregation and shamed. Watching this from an aisle seat in the pew, I will never forget. We never set foot in there again. Over the decades, Dad must have been proud of me, though his measured response to my returns from California usually began with, "Okay, Mark, what am I now no longer allowed to eat or say or think?" Even at 18, I successfully convinced my parents to vote for McGovern. In Oklahoma, that was saying something. It wasn't until after he passed and after my sister shared the letter he had written to Mom, a fuller picture of my father came into focus. He wrote an apology for not being the mate that he wanted to be and felt his wife deserved. There was nothing incriminating spelled out there, but what I picked up on was something that did not register with my sister, Mary. After fathering 4 of us and being a devoted husband for 47 years and connecting some dots on what I observed over the past 45 years, I was convinced he had wrestled with his own sexual orientation. This plight, I've heard, was typical during these times and places. my own avoidance of coming out made me who I am. I did all I could to preserve some kind of extraordinary son image for my parents, which also was made easier because everyone appeared predisposed to avoid difficult truths. There is a deep and unspoken understanding that materializes in long periods we have together and apart. And I wonder, as he was clutching that chocolate creamsicle, if we both didn't in some way come out to each other in our final moment. It was a knowing look he gave me. I had never faced mortality to this degree before, and I too could say nothing. I was overwhelmed. I have now lived past the age of most all of the men on my father's side of the family, and while I am enjoying every day, like father, like son, I must seize them. Maybe I'll grow tomatoes, or figure out how to best nurture my new mate, or try my hand at some writing. I don't know. Purpose, maybe legacy, seems to be important to most of us, particularly fathers, perhaps. Creating, inspiring, bestowing, hopefully something with at least a little shelf life. And what if, like so many did in Tulsa, what if my parents had discovered the Unitarian Church there? Perhaps that last look he gave me would have been accompanied with a smile, shared healthy tears, abiding love, and a better understanding. What if I had stumbled upon you all a year or more earlier and could manifest inherent worth and dignity to my own father? Just the other day, I came up with something new, something I had never even thought of before, but the roots of which were planted in me during childhood, thanks to my dad. A project which will probably take the rest of my days, but they'll be well spent, even if it's never read or seen until my gig is up. But more about all of that later. At least the dedication page is written.
My dad wanted a girl. I never wondered if he was disappointed that he didn't get a son. I'm an only child, and the daughter he wanted, or if that isn't true, he has been consistent and convincing in the lie, which is possible because my dad is an actor. Trained formerly with a master's in fine arts, skilled at everything from voice to set design. He worked as a director too sometimes, got a play that he directed in a small theater in New York, moved to Lincoln Center's Mitzi Newhouse Theater. That's the play that convinced us to move from Los Angeles to New York, where at the end of his career, my father was dean of the two-year school for film and television, which he helped create the core curriculum for and get acclaim and accreditation for, too. So my dad could have lied for 57 years, convincingly, about wanting a daughter. But I don't think he did. And he raised me as a particular kind of daughter, and I've been thinking about that a lot these last couple of years. My dad was, he still is alive, is adoring and physically affectionate and emotionally open and vulnerable and willing to apologize and tender. He was also, he is also tough, resilient, courageous. He worked in the oil fields in the summers and on vacations from the time he was 16 as what was called, and I suppose still is called, a roughneck. Hard work out in the open, throwing chains and racking drill pipe, dangerous work and back-breaking work, and he did it. He is one of those people who has never worried that he couldn't make a living, and that does give you a kind of confidence. My dad's family moved around a lot and constantly, maybe more than they needed to, as my grandfather followed his work in the drilling business. It meant needing to go to make a go of new places and new people, navigate new schools constantly, something my father did not enjoy at all and regrets. But he did it. It gave him some resilience and a strong dose of self-reliance. It also, I think, meant he grounded himself in places that wouldn't go away. The world of books and movies, stories of other places, the adventures he would be able to navigate that were in the future, that were better than what this or that small town was offering in the moment. And though, like anyone, I'm sure he was sensitive to the opinions of others, I think he learned not to be dependent on them. It would have destroyed anyone, always the new kid, to be too sensitive or dependent on the opinion of others, since the stranger always gets scrutiny and a level of distrust. And my dad chose an unusual path for his life and his community. He went to college, he studied theater in Texas. When he read everything, handing in Plato's Symposium once as a teenager to an unbelieving librarian who, when she challenged him, he summarized for her the plot, which even I could not do. Pop was willing to forge his own way outside of the world he knew. Married a recent immigrant from the Netherlands, loved the perspective and life experiences she brought to their life, as well as so much else about her. And all of that and more was passed on to his daughter. Passing it on to a son would be less astounding, I think, more expected. Of course, you want your son to be strong and self-reliant and resilient and courageous and free-thinking. We don't always want our daughters to be all that. And I wasn't the daughter who was the booby prize for the son he wanted and so got this treatment because he was pretending I was a son. My dad wanted a daughter. And he wanted her to be strong and wise and capable and fearless. That's no small thing. He could be and was tender, like I said, but he also demanded all the rest, and he gave permission for all the rest. Vanessa, here's how you throw a tight spiral. Play hard defense. Speak your truth, stand up to the bullies. Do well in school, argue fiercely your position. Don't be afraid, well, except when your life is in danger. Be smart on the streets, and he'd show me how. But don't be afraid of things that don't deserve fear, like social judgment. Be bold, defend the weak. Say what is your truth, even if it's not popular. He never said to me, be nice. Except with a smile and a wink. Hey, kid, be nice. And when I left home for a night out, he always said, don't do anything stupid. A tender love showing up protectively. I was allowed to be loving, passionate, strong, tough, tender, courageous, kind, all of it. And I've been aware of this particular gift, the gift of this legacy lately, the courage part in particular. The who gives a damn part. I've always been surprised when people shrank away from silly things, confounded by it. The girl in sixth grade who wouldn't stand up to the mean girls. The people who stand frozen on the train or bus or street when someone is in trouble or being threatened. Folks who won't say to someone they know, hey, you know that thing you did or said, it wasn't cool, it didn't land right. I mean, seriously, is all that so scary and so hard? But then there are those places, or I should say, but then those are the places where we practice. And the failure of building up this muscle, it's so much bigger, isn't it? Legislators and judges who know what's happening is not right but won't stick their heads up to say so, it's the same thing. The billionaires and the universities and the partners at white shoe law firms, all of them with money and power, who try to stay safe, that pathetic vision of safety, not of shared power or of commitment to shared greatness, to human solidarity in a world that is bound together with visions of justice and compassion and mutuality and interdependence, but who instead cower and placate and tie a leash around their own privileged necks and hand the end of it to the devil, to all that is evil. And it says in the gospel, according to Matthew chapter 16, verse 26, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? To not forfeit our souls, it requires courage. It requires this well-honed, deep well of self-reliance, of confidence in our own judgment, of trust in our resilience, and the courage to speak our truths, to hold the world accountable, and if necessary, walk alone. Take the blows, but to be in the arena of life, wild and alive, not a spectator, gutsy and demanding, a gladiator for the good, if it's possible to use that metaphor, if gladiators can be good. And my mother, she gave me some of that for sure. She is an incredible woman of strength and wisdom and compassion. But I'm realizing there is something special about a father giving his daughter permission and expecting her to be all that too. So thanks, Papa. Thanks, Richard Southern. Hard-won lessons you learned, given me to live. May we all live them. May we all live them. May we all live them. Amen.